In our previous lecture, we looked at the Supreme Court during the decade of the 1920s, under the conservative leadership of Chief Justice William Howard Taft. We examined several of the court's landmark rulings in the areas of free speech, economic regulation, and the education of children. We saw that the court took different positions on the limits of legislative power in these areas. The justices upheld state power to punish the advocacy of revolution, but they also struck down laws that set minimum wages for women, that prohibited the teaching of foreign languages in public and private schools, and that required all parents to send their children to public schools. In all these cases, the court balanced the police powers of government to protect the public health and welfare against the liberty interests of political radicals, of employers and their workers, and of parents and teachers. In this lecture, we'll look at the court's major decisions in the years that followed the stock market collapse in October of 1929 through the first administration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. These were tumultuous years in American society and politics. Roosevelt ended 12 years of Republican control of the White House with a sweeping victory over President Herbert Hoover in the 1932 election, and with the promise of a New Deal for the American people. Dry statistics cannot fully convey the human toll of the Great Depression. The stock market lost almost 90% of its value between 1929 and 1933. Industrial production fell more than 50% during these years. Some 15 million workers, almost a third of the workforce, lost their jobs. And farm income continued its post-war slide from $17 billion in 1919 to just $5 billion in 1932. Many people spent their days scrabbling for survival. One reporter in the nation's heartland described their plight in these words: "There is not a garbage dump in Chicago which is not diligently haunted by the hungry, falling on heaps of refuse and digging it with sticks and hands." Another story from Chicago in 1932 reported hundreds of children parading to the Board of Education to demand that the schools provide them with food. During his campaign for the White House that same year, Roosevelt pledged strong federal action. "The country needs," he said, "bold, persistent experimentation to restore the shattered economy." Congress honored that pledge by creating new federal agencies to revive business and agriculture. During its famous 100 Days session in early 1933, Congress established the National Recovery Administration and the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the so-called Blue Eagle and AAA programs. The NRA allowed business and industry groups to adopt codes of fair competition that allowed them to set prices and production quotas. And the AAA program imposed taxes on agricultural processors that were passed directly to farmers who agreed to cut their production of livestock and produce. But the New Deal lawyers who drafted these laws, and many of the congressmen who voted for them, admitted they stood on shaky constitutional ground. One of the lawyers who drafted the National Recovery Act was a young Harvard graduate named Charles Wyszanski. He confessed to his mentor, Professor Felix Frankfurter of Harvard Law School, that the law went so far beyond the bounds of constitutionality that it would be useless to expose it to judicial scrutiny. And it was certain that the New Deal laws would be exposed to judicial scrutiny. Many small business owners felt the codes of fair competition favored big business and were unfair to them. And some agricultural processors, like the Armour Meatpacking Company, complained that payments to farmers had cut their profits. Congress had set up a judicial showdown with the federal courts, and everyone looked to the Supreme Court for final decisions on the New Deal laws. Once again, the justices would balance the police powers of government against the liberty of those who opposed federal regulation of their businesses. President Roosevelt enjoyed a hefty Democratic majority in both houses of Congress, but he faced a Republican majority on the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Taft had died in March of 1930, after 9 years at the court's helm. President Hoover replaced him with Charles Evans Hughes, a former Supreme Court justice who had resigned in 1916 to campaign as the Republican candidate for president. But he narrowly lost that election to Woodrow Wilson and had entered a lucrative Wall Street law practice. Hoover's nomination of Hughes as Chief Justice had provoked opposition from progressive senators of both parties who considered him a tool of big business. "No man in public life," declared Senator George Norris of Nebraska, "so exemplifies the influence of powerful combinations in the political and financial world as does Mr. Hughes." But the Senate confirmed Hughes by a vote of 52-26, in contrast to the unanimous vote for his first term on the court. President Hoover also placed two more justices on the court. He replaced Justice Edward Sanford in 1930 with Owen Roberts of Pennsylvania, a wealthy corporate lawyer who had garnered praise as special prosecutor in the Teapot Dome scandals of the 1920s. Hoover's third choice for the court was a highly respected New York State judge, Benjamin Cardozo, who became the second Jewish justice, serving with Louis Brandeis. Cardozo replaced Oliver Wendell Holmes, who ended an era in American law with his resignation in 1932 at the age of 90. Like Holmes, Cardozo was a noted legal scholar and had served as chief judge of his state's highest court. But unlike Holmes, who looked back to the common law for guidance, Cardozo looked ahead to statutory law and administrative regulations as signposts for the future. The court that would decide the fate of New Deal laws also included four conservative justices, James McReynolds, George Sutherland, Willis Van Devaner, and Pierce Butler, who became known as the Four Horsemen of Reaction. As we saw in our previous lecture, this judicial faction voted as a bloc to strike down federal laws in the 1920s. They were matched on the court by what I call the Three Musketeers, as Justice Cardozo soon joined the court's liberal bloc with Louis Brandeis and Harlan Fiske Stone. Between these two factions, Chief Justice Hughes and Justice Roberts became the court's swing votes. If either man voted with the Four Horsemen, a law would be struck down. But if Hughes and Roberts both sided with the Three Musketeers, a law would be upheld. This judicial arithmetic would answer the questions raised by the New Deal cases that reached the court in the 1930s. Before they ruled on the big cases that challenged the New Deal programs that Congress had adopted in 1933, the justices faced two important cases that involved little New Deal laws from the states of Minnesota and New York. Lawmakers in these states had enacted programs to protect homeowners from mortgage foreclosures and consumers from high prices. The first case that reached the Supreme Court began when the Minnesota legislature passed a mortgage moratorium law in April of 1933. This law extended for 2 years the period in which homeowners could redeem property foreclosed by mortgage holders by making payments set by a state judge. The law's preamble stated that the severe economic and financial depression had created an emergency that justified the exercise of the state's police powers to protect homeowners who fell behind on their mortgage payments. The Supreme Court faced a challenge to this law in a case that stemmed from one of thousands of foreclosures during the Depression. John Blaisdell had obtained a $15,000 mortgage for a house in Minneapolis from the Home Building and Loan Association. Blaisdell and his family lived in three rooms and rented out the others. He fell behind on payments when his tenants lost their jobs and moved out. Home Building foreclosed the mortgage and purchased the house at auction for $3,700. Blaisdell ran to the state court and got an extension for 2 years, conditioned on payments of $40 each month. Home Building's lawyers appealed this judgment and claimed the mortgage moratorium law violated the impairment of contract clause of the federal constitution. The company won the first round in state court, and Blaisdell sued to reclaim his property. After Minnesota's highest court ruled for Blaisdell and upheld the law, Home Building appealed to the Supreme Court. Now, in this closely watched case, Chief Justice Hughes and Justice Roberts sided with the Three Musketeers and sustained the law in January of 1934 over the dissent of the Four Horsemen of Reaction. Hughes wrote for the majority of five in Home Building and Loan versus Blaisdell. The Chief Justice conceded that the Minnesota law did impair Home Building's contract with John Blaisdell. But that impairment was not complete or permanent. Hughes argued that the court's task in construing what he called the broad outlines of constitutional provisions was to fill in the details with judicial interpretation. Extending the mortgage for another 2 years was simply a detail that did not violate the contract clause. Hughes also looked at the financial emergency caused by the Great Depression. The Constitution was adopted in a period of grave emergency, he wrote. While emergency does not create power, emergency may furnish the occasion for the exercise of power. Minnesota's lawmakers could exercise their state's police powers to assist people like John Blaisdell, who faced the personal emergency of losing his home. This was too much for the Four Horsemen. Justice Sutherland replied to Hughes in a scornful dissent. The Minnesota statute either impairs the obligations of contracts or it does not, he wrote. Sutherland did not find an emergency exit in the contract clause. States could not impair contract rights, he stated, no matter what may be the occasion. Sutherland warned that Hughes had opened the door for what he called gradual but ever-advancing encroachments upon the sanctity of public and private contracts. New Deal supporters cheered the court's ruling in the Blaisdell case, hoping it was a harbinger of decisions to uphold the Blue Eagle and AAA programs. They were even more cheered by the court's ruling in another state case, 2 months later in March of 1934. This decision upheld a New York law that established a state milk control board with the power to fix prices for milk sold in retail stores. The problem was not too little milk for the state's consumers, but too much. Swelling production and shrinking consumption had driven the prices that farmers received far below their costs. The board fixed the price of a quart of milk at 9 cents for retail stores. But dealers who delivered milk to homes were not covered by the law and generally sold a quart for 8 cents, giving their customers better service and lower prices. Leo Nebbia, who ran a grocery in upstate Rochester, fought back by selling a 5 cent loaf of bread with 2 quarts of milk for 18 cents. In effect, he gave away the bread to lure customers into his store. Nebbia volunteered to bring a test case on behalf of fellow grocers, and the county attorney arranged a quick trial at which Nebbia was convicted and fined $25. The state's highest court rejected Nebbia's claim of a liberty right to set his own prices and upheld the law as an exercise of the state's police powers to further the welfare of farmers and consumers. The stakes in Nebbia versus New York were much greater than a nickel loaf of bread. Price fixing was an essential part of the New Deal program, and the National Recovery Act was based on setting prices and production quotas. So the Supreme Court's ruling on a state law might forecast its decision on the federal recovery program. The justices lined up in Nebbia as they had in the home building case. This time, Justice Owen Roberts wrote for the majority and James McReynolds for the Four Horsemen in dissent. Roberts did not need an emergency exit in this case. He cited the 1877 ruling in Munn versus Illinois for the proposition that property rights are not absolute. Roberts put his views in these words: equally fundamental with the private right is that of the public to regulate it in the common interest. So long as laws were not arbitrary, Roberts added, the state may regulate a business in any of its aspects, including the prices to be charged. This was far too much for the Four Horsemen. Justice Sutherland had warned in his home building dissent that the sanctity of contracts was in grave peril. Justice McReynolds saw a much greater danger in the Nebbia ruling. He used these ominous words in his dissent: the court's facile disregard of the Constitution, as long interpreted and respected, will inevitably lead to its destruction. Then all rights will be subject to the caprice of the hour. Government by stable laws will pass. Now, we looked in earlier lectures at the debate over judicial restraint and judicial activism. We can view the court's rulings in the home building and Nebbia cases as examples of judicial restraint, upholding the decisions of elected lawmakers. And the dissents of the four horsemen in these cases sounded a call for judicial activism in defense of contract and liberty rights. But as we turn to the court's rulings in the big New Deal cases, we'll see how these conflicting positions were quickly reversed. The court's first ruling on the laws passed by Congress in 1933 came in January of 1935. The case of Panama Refining Company versus Ryan involved a section of the National Recovery Act known as the Hot Oil Law. Congress had banned the interstate shipment of petroleum that was produced in excess of production quotas set by the states. Much like the milk control law in the Nebbia case, the problem was too much oil and falling prices. But the Supreme Court found a more serious problem with the hot oil law. Congress had authorized President Roosevelt to approve the state production quotas without setting any standards for him to follow. The oil company's lawyers invoked the separation of powers doctrine, arguing that Congress had improperly delegated a legislative function to the executive branch of government. The Supreme Court agreed over the solitary dissent of Justice Cardozo. Chief Justice Hughes wrote for the majority in the Panama refining case, holding that Congress had set, as he put it, no criterion to govern the president's course in approving the state quotas. The court warned the New Dealers that they couldn't speed up the recovery program by taking legislative shortcuts. The court's next ruling brought the recovery program to a screeching halt. We're going to look now at what became known as the sick chicken case. One of the codes of fair competition under the National Recovery Act covered the poultry business in New York City. The four Schechter brothers, Joseph, Martin, Aaron, and Alex, ran a wholesale business in Brooklyn that slaughtered and dressed kosher poultry. Every day, trucks from the Schechter Poultry Company would cross the Brooklyn Bridge to the Manhattan Railway Terminal. Strong men would load hundreds of coops that contained about 100 chickens onto their trucks and return with their squawking cargo to the Schechter's slaughterhouse. Butchers known as shochtim would then slit the chickens' throats and drain the blood under rabbinical supervision. After plucking and dressing, the birds went to retail shops that catered to the city's large Jewish population. Now, the Schechter brothers had a reputation for shady business practices. It didn't take Joe Schechter and his brothers long to see the advantage of breaking the code, wrote journalist Drew Pearson, and it didn't take enforcement officers long to catch them. Federal investigators uncovered evidence the Schechters had sold thousands of pounds of diseased birds. Government lawyers filed a criminal indictment with 60 charges against the brothers and their company in July of 1934. One count alleged that the Schechters had unlawfully sold for human consumption an unfit chicken to Harry Stauber. It was this charge that gave the case its label as the sick chicken case. The Schechters were also charged with paying their workers less than 50 cents an hour and with taking payoffs for allowing favored customers to pick the best chickens from the coops. These acts were both violations of the poultry code. After a three-week trial, a federal jury convicted the Schechters on 19 counts, and Judge Marcus Campbell imposed jail terms of 1 to 3 months. Federal circuit judges upheld the convictions on 17 counts, but they also ruled that the code's wage and hour provisions did not affect interstate commerce and reversed the convictions on those counts. The appeal in Schechter Poultry Company versus the United States reached the Supreme Court in May of 1935. The Solicitor General in the Justice Department, a Kentucky lawyer named Stanley Reed, argued for the government, and he wound up with egg on his face. Reed defended the Recovery Act as an exercise of congressional power to regulate commerce among the several states. And he pointed to evidence that 96% of the chickens sold in New York City were shipped from other states. But he faced a question from Justice Sutherland. Is everything that the defendants do, which affects the poultry, done after it is passed to them? Reed conceded that the chickens, as he said, came to rest in the Schechter shop before they were slaughtered and sold. Justice Stone posed another question. In approving the Recovery Act codes, he asked, what is the standard which the president has to follow? Reed weakly replied that there is no primary standard in the statute other than that of fair competition. Caught between hostile questions from one of the conservative four horsemen and from one of the liberal three musketeers, Reed was figuratively plucked and drawn before he left the podium. Chief Justice Hughes wrote for a unanimous court in striking down the Recovery Act. He first addressed the Commerce Clause issue that Justice Sutherland had raised. Hughes looked at the chickens and concluded that they had come to roost in Brooklyn. So far as the poultry here in question is concerned, he wrote, the flow in interstate commerce had ceased. The poultry had come to a permanent rest within the state. Hughes ruled that Congress had no authority to regulate a business that was not engaged in interstate commerce. He then turned to the delegation issue that Justice Stone had raised in his question to Solicitor General Reed. The Recovery Act conferred what Hughes called a virtually unfettered discretion on the president to approve the codes of fair competition that business groups drafted. The Chief Justice concluded with these words, we think that the code-making authority thus conferred is an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power. Now, the court's ruling in the sick chicken case produced a major bout of presidential indigestion. 2 days after the decision, Roosevelt invited reporters into the Oval Office for an off-the-record chat. He waved a sheaf of telegrams urging him to ask Congress to fix the Recovery Act. Roosevelt complained that the court had thrown the recovery program, as he put it, straight in our faces, and we have been relegated to the horse and buggy definition of interstate commerce. The reporters begged the president to put the horse and buggy quote on the record, but Roosevelt resisted their pleas. 2 days later, after thousands of telegrams flooded the White House, Roosevelt called a formal press conference and spoke to 200 reporters for 90 minutes. After reading more than 20 messages from the public, he held up a copy of the court's opinion. The implications of this decision, he said, are much more important than almost certainly any decision of my lifetime or yours. More important, probably, than any decision since the Dred Scott case. Roosevelt then repeated his horse and buggy quote, and reporters galloped to their typewriters. Newspapers across the country put the quote in their headlines, and millions of people read more about the president's spat in the next issue of Time magazine. Roosevelt's speech, as Time put it, was obviously a trial balloon, testing the winds of public support for measures to curb the court's power to strike down the recovery program. The president did not follow up his trial balloon with any formal proposal to deal with the court's ruling in the Schechter case. He decided to wait for its ruling on the AAA program for cutting agricultural production and boosting farmers' incomes. More than 7 months passed before the court issued its decision in United States versus Butler in January of 1936. This case began with efforts by government lawyers to collect overdue processing taxes from the Hoosac cotton mills in western Massachusetts. The company had gone bankrupt, a victim of hard times in the textile industry. But the government filed a suit against one of the company's receivers, William Butler, seeking to collect $81,000 from its assets. Government lawyers soon discovered that Hoosac Mills was controlled by the board chairman of the Armour Meatpacking Company, who had picked the bankrupt firm to force a test case of the AAA's processing taxes. The Armour Company hired a leading Wall Street lawyer, George Horton Pepper, to argue for William Butler in the Supreme Court after federal circuit judges ruled against the government. Solicitor General Reed faced two major obstacles in defending the AAA program. First, the powers granted to Congress by Article I of the Constitution did not include regulation of agriculture. Secondly, the taxes collected from the processors bypassed the national treasury and went directly to farmers. The only path Reed could find around these roadblocks took him to the clause in Article 1 that gave Congress power to lay and collect taxes for the general welfare of the United States. The justices had never before construed the general welfare clause, and Reed knew he faced an uphill climb in his argument. But he boldly claimed the court should read the clause to include, as he put it, anything conducive to the national welfare. Reed appealed to the court not to substitute its judgment for that of Congress on the broad reach of this power. George Pepper answered that Reed was asking the court to give Congress what he called an unlimited power to tax for any purpose which could be obtained by inflating the general welfare clause to the utmost. The court issued its ruling in the Butler case on January 6th of 1936. Now, we should keep in mind that this was a presidential election year and that President Roosevelt would be seeking a second term in the White House that November. So the court's chamber was packed with reporters and spectators when Justice Owen Roberts began reading from his opinion. Roberts plowed through the facts of the case and the law's provisions before he announced his conclusion. Congress had no power under the Constitution to regulate agriculture. This was entirely a field reserved for the states. Construing the General Welfare Clause as broadly as Reed had urged, Roberts said, would make it the instrument for total subversion of the governmental powers reserved to the individual states. With this statement, almost at the end of his lengthy opinion, Roberts knocked down the second pillar of the New Deal recovery program. Chief Justice Hughes joined Roberts and the four horsemen of reaction to make up a 6-3 majority in the Butler case. But the three musketeers who had joined the Schechter ruling were unwilling to strip Congress of its power to provide for the general welfare of the country. Justice Roberts had said nothing in his opinion about the economic plight of farmers and the inability of hard-pressed states to help them save their farms. Speaking for Justices Brandeis and Cardozo in a sharp dissent, Justice Stone blasted Roberts' opinion, calling it a tortured construction of the Constitution that substituted judicial fiat for the judgment of Congress. Stone argued, as he put it, that the power to tax and spend includes the power to relieve a nationwide economic maladjustment by conditional gifts of money to those who are distressed. Stone also echoed the admonition of Chief Justice Morrison Waite in the Munn case in 1877. Stone put his warning in these words: "For the removal of unwise laws from the statute books, appeal lies not to the courts, but to the ballot and to the processes of democratic government." The American people would mark their ballots in the presidential election some 10 months later, and everyone knew the Supreme Court would become an issue in that campaign. But President Roosevelt decided to hold his tongue after the Butler ruling. Time magazine informed its readers that when an aide handed Roosevelt a news ticker report of the court's decision in the Butler case, he just held the sheet of paper in front of him on his desk and smiled. Whether he would be smiling after the election remained to be seen. Now, we've seen in this lecture that the court's ruling in New Deal cases were more than judicial opinions. They had political consequences as well. In our next lecture, we'll continue this story through the election of 1936 and look at the turmoil that swirled around President Roosevelt's famous court-packing plan in 1937.